Now I'm recording. The three facts about the brain. All right, so first fact, as the brain changes, the mind changes, for better and for worse. We've got the for better, sort of, I don't know if Jan would approve on the left slide there, the Coke, all that. You know, there are about 45 grams of sugar in a can of Coke, just right there, all right? On the other hand, the brain can change for worse on the right-hand slide, which is a picture of an NFL player getting a concussion, all right? It's also a fact that as the mind changes, the brain changes. In other words, they co-arise in an interdependent way. Modern neuroscience continually finds things out that people like the Buddha were saying 2,500 years ago. These changes due to flows of mental activity, thoughts, feelings, memories, hopes, dreams, upsets, anger, sadness, fear, and all the rest, those changes of mind are associated with changes of brain in both temporary and lasting ways. For example, some of the temporary ways include activation of regions or parts of the brain that do particular things that are being used by the mind at that moment. So this is a picture of a Tibetan monk in an MRI who's engaged with boundless compassion. All right. The part of the brain that's particularly active is shown in the orange blob there. It's about 2 to 3% more metabolically active than the rest of the brain. It's not like the rest of the brain has gone dark. It's just that this part is using about 2 to 3% more oxygen, essentially. But it's a significant difference, and it's a part of the brain called the anterior, which means frontal cingulate cortex. And it is involved in a number of functions, particularly the executive control of attention. So here's this person trying to be compassionate for all beings, right, inside this weird tube with banging magnets all around, right? He's got to concentrate, all right? So that's lit up right there. To the extent that you're paying good attention here, you too are lighting up your anterior cingulate cortex, all right? So this is a temporary change of neural activity based on changes of mental activity. Those changes also can be lasting. And this is getting really at the heart of the opportunity here. In other words, what flows through the mind sculpts the brain, leaving traces behind. It does it in a variety of ways. Busy regions of the brain get more blood flow over time. It's a little bit like the change from a small, sleepy hamlet that gets a country road coming into it and out of it to a big, bustling, you know, metropolis that has many, many freeways and train stations and airports and all the rest of that. It's also the case that mental activity can change the expression of genes. In other words, the action of strips of atoms inside the longer molecule of DNA, which is still so small that no technology can actually see it. For example, people who routinely practice relaxation get improved expression of the gene that helps manage the stress response. Somehow, mental activity works its way down there to little strips of atoms inside a larger molecule. It's also the case that, as the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb's work showed, neurons that fire together wire together. For example, existing synapses that are very busy become ever more sensitive, and neurons that fire together in association with each other also build synapses to new synapses. There is, of course, as well, what's called neural Darwinism, or survival of the busiest. For example, when you were three, you had about three times as many synapses as you do today. It's not that you've gotten dumber with age, although maybe some of us have. I don't know. I think there are things I knew when I was three that I've forgotten, and I'm trying to relearn now in my 50s. But anyway, it's that synapses that are not active wither away, and those that are busy get nurtured, and they grow. Okay. One of the ways this can be seen is in the ways in which busy regions of the brain, in other words, regions of the brain that correspond to frequent mental activity, actually become thicker. For example, in this particular study, this was done on long-term meditators, typically in the Buddhist tradition, doing mindfulness practices. And it showed that three regions were measurably thicker in the meditators compared with a control group. The three regions are, number one, the insula. It's a part of the brain that is very involved in interoception, tracking the interior state of the body, as well as feelings, particularly deep feelings. And the insula also does empathy for the emotions of others. And we'll be getting to that later on in one of the sections I have on loved and loving. All right. The second region, number two, is related to the anterior cingulate cortex. In other words, if you routinely pay attention in a structured and focused way, because that very much is the essence of mindfulness meditation, you will actually build out neural structure. You get more synapses, you get more blood flow, you get more capacity. It's like literally building a muscle in a certain sense. You have more muscle mass, you can lift more weight. You have more cortical tissue, you can do more things. So the people who routinely meditate have a thicker part of the brain that has to do with controlling attention. That's number two. And then number three, somatosensory cortex, basically they're tuning into their body. They're getting some little thickening there. All right. The other interesting thing is seen in the slide at the very bottom there, or the portion of the slide at the bottom, particularly the lower right-hand corner. If you compare people who meditate over the long haul with people who don't, the normal cortical thinning that occurs with age, in other words, the control group is seen in the red squares, the meditators are the blue circles. Normally we lose about 10,000 brain cells a day. That may seem like a lot, but if you start with 1.1 trillion, it means you've lost about 4% by the time you're 80 years old. I was told with great authority in a neuropsychology continuing ed class I once took, where the guy literally did pull a brain out of a bucket, which is quite impressive. I never forgot that one. We apparently lose also about 10,000 brain cells with a single drink. Alcohol gives us that nice buzz by depriving brain cells of oxygen. In other words, the buzz is brain cells drowning. Oh well. So this is the bummer portion. There's such a bummer here. Sugar, bad. Chocolate, questionable. Alcohol, problematic. Bummer, bummer, bummer. But anyway, there is some good news. All right. So anyway, we normally lose cells. That's cortical thinning. Interestingly, if you look at the lower right-hand slide, you can see that people who just did not do any kind of meditative practice, they did not work these parts of the brain in a particular way, experienced normal cortical thinning with age. In other words, that's that downward line. Whereas the people who routinely used it, right, use it or lose it, they did not experience cortical thinning in those portions of the brain. That's the line straight across running through the blue circles. And that's another example of the ways in which, as the mind changes, the brain changes. This means the third fact about the brain. And this is the takeaway fact. This is the important one. We can use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. That gives us an incredible power over what's going on inside the black box, particularly at a time when so many of us feel buffeted by powerful forces in the economy, our relationships, our reactions to these factors that seem so much out of our own control. But in this area, we really can be more of a hammer and less of a nail in terms of how we skillfully intervene over time to use the mind alone to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. How do we do this? Okay, and that's what I'm going to talk about here. So one of the first ways to do it is in terms of mindfulness. Because, as I said earlier, neurons that fire together wire together, to be sure, but they do so particularly with what's held in the field of awareness and especially for what's in the focal spotlight of attention. Attention is, as I just said, like a spotlight. It illuminates what it rests upon, but it's also like a vacuum cleaner. Sucks that information into the brain. Therefore, getting control of that spotlight, being able to put it someplace that's useful or to pull it away from someplace that's not useful is, as William James said 100 years ago, the father of American psychology, that is an education par excellence. So how do we do it, right? Because we did not evolve to be able to, we basically evolved to have skittery attention. I mean, monkey mind. If you think about it, our ancestors that were really into, really chilling, the sunlight on the leaves, this is so groovy. I've read Buddha's brain 10 million years ago, I'm all mellow. They got eaten, right? They didn't notice the shadow overhead or the slither nearby, right? The ancestors who are nervous, you know, and irritable, they passed on their genes. We are their great-grandchildren sitting atop the food chain with nuclear weapons in the 21st century. Right? So there's a challenge here, which I'll get to a little bit later. All right, so what do we do about it? How do we tap this power of mindfulness? All right, so I want to talk here about two sort of ways of being. This is, yes, a little dualistic. That said, there is clearly a distinction, for example, between, let's say, the second line down on the doing column, lots and lots of inner language versus a mind that's quite quiet. There's a difference. We know the difference between the two, right? Or go all the way down to the last two. There's a difference between taking things really personally, having a lot of I going, you know, a lot of me, a lot of mine, versus a sense of, you know, a kind of, there's a personhood there, but there's not a strong sense of self. There's a kind of relaxation of me, myself, and I. All right? There are these two ways of being. It's interesting that in the brain, okay, and you can see that these two ways of being actually have a lot of interest. Modern life is an education in the left-hand column. Conventional schooling is a deep training in the left-hand column. There is a place for the left-hand column, but most of us are not as skillful as we really could be or afford to be in terms of the right-hand column. All right. So how do we develop that right-hand column? And it's very interesting that these two columns, these two modes of being that kind of cluster together, are associated with two distinct networks in your brain. Mindfulness very much involves, particularly open, spacious mindfulness, involves the right-hand column. So how do we activate the neural networks that are involved in that right-hand column of spacious awareness? Key question, right? Okay. So the networks that are associated with the left-hand column are mainly in the midline. Right? And this is what we light up when we're doing a lot of what we're doing right now. We're thinking, we're trying to, you know, understand things. There's a lot of language here. If, for example, we're just kind of ruminating away about the future, the past, with ourselves, you know, as a main character in that drama, where those little mini movies are running, we're lighting up midline networks. On the other hand, if we are in a state of open awareness, we tend to light up networks on the sides of the brain, especially the right-hand side, which kind of makes sense because for most people, the right hemisphere is associated with visual spatial processing and gestalt processing. Left hemisphere does sequential processing. That's why it's specialized for fine motor control and also for language, because language is sequential. Whereas the right hemisphere is specialized for gestalt processing, holistic processing, which is involved, obviously, in imagery. It's interesting that in childhood, the right hemisphere tends to develop, you know, it has that edge in terms of development during the first year or two of life, which makes a lot of sense when you think about our ancient ancestors who, even as little kids, had to track threats from the environment that are coming from the surround. That's very much what the right hemisphere is involved in. Okay, what's interesting is that if you take people without training, and this is what this study showed, and you say, okay, think about something that's important to you, plan it out, etc., they light up midline networks. If on the other hand you say, okay, be with your experience, just kind of open up, relax, and be with whatever's there without getting caught up in it, right? Sounds like basic mindfulness instructions, they will light up lateral networks. And they'll be able to sustain, these untrained people, lateral activation for about 10 seconds. And then they have what we've all experienced if we've ever tried to follow something as sort of boring as the breath, breath after breath after breath. Whoop! They're back into planning their shopping list for the next trip to Safeway, you know, or thinking about that irritating argument they had with some family member or coworker, etc. All right. However, this study showed that with just something like 8 weeks of pretty basic training, you know, mindfulness practice, maybe 20 minutes a day, people can stabilize the activation of the lateral networks. In other words, here, as their mind is changing, in other words, as they're getting better at sustaining open, spacious mindfulness, that correlates with a brain that's changing in terms of more stable activation of these lateral networks. Okay? So then the question becomes how to do it, right? You're seeing here the demonstration that this stuff works. All right, how do we do it? In other words, how do we live more in the right-hand column at will, right? We need to do the left-hand column, but how do we do the right-hand column when it's appropriate? All right. So we all know how to activate the doing mode, right? That one's easy. Feel threatened, right? midline activation, or sense a great opportunity, either a huge stick coming at you or a super carrot, bam, midline activation, generally speaking. Think with language. Reflect about the future or the past, or take something very personally. You looking at me? You know? Or do you? What do you think about me right now? You know? Right? Midline activation. Okay. Now, activating being mode. There's some really great ways to do it, and I'm going to take you through momentarily an experiential practice that focuses on two of them. So there are a number of ways to do it. I think these are really accessible go-tos. The ones that I'm going to focus on are sensing the body as a whole and having a bird's eye view, a kind of panoramic awareness with regard to one's own experience. All right. And a word about experiential practices, feel very free to to not do them, the ones that we're doing, I'm going to be taking you through momentarily, or adapt them to your own purposes. None of these are aimed at any kind of scary or difficult or traumatic material. They're all really benign. But sometimes just tuning into oneself can feel a little alarming. You know, by the way, particularly if you have any kind of trauma history, you know, it's an important point there. And so I will use, for example, in particular, the suggestion that you pay attention to the body, especially something like breathing. If that is alarming for you, you know, shift your attention to something else that's benign, like the sensations in your feet, or opening your eyes and just looking out at this beautiful view. Okay? Okay. So with regard to these two, I will say one kind of cool way to activate lateral networks is to, when you're sort of just kind of hanging out or present, either formally in a meditative practice or informally where you're just sort of being with someone, a nice way to activate lateral networks is to allow things to not necessarily connect with each other. In other words, to allow thoughts, feelings, sensations, the material going through the mind to just arise and pass away independently, as it were. A really wonderful Tibetan teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, said, the problem isn't that we have thoughts, broadly defined, it's that we try to glue them together. You know, and the midline networks are very dense. They're like the freeways in LA where I grew up. Whereas the lateral networks are a little bit more like country roads. There isn't that great density of connectivity there, which probably corresponds to a sense of letting things not need to connect with each other. All right. I won't do that as a practice here, but if you do meditate or you want to play around with this, that's a nice method. Okay? So, you want to try to do something experiential? You up for that? All right? Great. Okay. So, this one has to do with sensing the body as a whole. And as I mentioned, the more we go out into a kind of gestalt awareness, where everything is present as a whole, as it is in a picture, you know, the whole picture is present right there, okay? That sunflower is one whole thing, or that vista of the Grand Canyon is one whole thing, even if it has many parts to it. So we're going to try to do this. This is actually not easy in the beginning for many people, me included. But with some practice, you can drop into this state of the body as a whole, or even a greater challenge, all of experience as a whole, really kind of at will, including in busy situations like business meetings. All right, so let's try it here. So with your eyes open or closed, and it might help to let your eyes gently close, recalling that this is a protected setting and a beautiful environment surrounded with good people, so it's okay to let those eyes close if you want to. Pick up the sensations of the breath. And as I said, use something else if the breath is difficult for you. So for example, at the belly or the chest or the upper lip, or inside the throat, cool air going in, warm air going out, sense the breath in one part of your body. In effect, give your mind into your breath. And then staying with the breath, see if you can experience it as a whole. In other words, expand awareness to track all of the sensations of breathing. In other words, in the belly, in the chest, around the upper lip and nose, and inside the throat itself, the airways of the throat, the breath as one whole gestalt, all those sensations present and known at once. Often there's a gestalt sense for a second or two and then it crumbles. That's fine and normal. See if you can go back to it, kind of relaxing and opening to the sensations all together as a whole of breathing. And then if you like, see if you can expand that sense of a whole to track all the sensations in your body at once. A way into that is to, in a sense, sense the breath breathing the body. So there's an opening to experiencing all the sensations in the body, not just those of breathing, as one unified thing. One whole. And then if you like, expand even further to see if you can experience all of experience as a unified whole. So there is what's called a unification of consciousness. Along with body sensations, sounds, thoughts, feelings, all of what's in the field of awareness, moment by moment, as one whole thing, one whole.
And then allowing whatever sense of the whole is present to remain. Recall a time in which you had a bird's eye view, maybe from atop a mountain or looking out through the window of an airplane. Or just imagine a bird's eye view, a sense of great vistas before you, panoramic awareness. And then bring that sense of a panoramic view of great spaciousness to your own experiencing. For example, be aware of sounds coming and going without any edge to them. Awareness like the sky, boundless, without an edge, through which sounds and thoughts and sensations and other contents of mind come and go like clouds. Some clouds feel pleasant. Some feel unpleasant. Either is fine. They're just clouds. And no thought, no feeling, no pleasant, no unpleasant ever change the sky. Awareness is never harmed or tainted by whatever passes through it. Whatever quality of spaciousness of mind is present for you here, really get a sense of it sinking into you, so that your brain and your mind and your body is really registering the fruits of this practice, whatever they've been for you, registering open, steady awareness. Okay, come on back. Be gentle with yourself. A question or comment about this, and then we'll move on. Fine. What? Yeah?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, I don't know, to what the thing to be okay with, I think, is that whatever you experienced was okay, including as you train the mind. That's a lot of what we're doing. We're training the mind, which means we're changing the brain. It's okay if in the beginning it's difficult, right? For example, if people are learning how to ride a bike, to use an obvious example, they hang in there with it.
I've known a number of people who try to change their mind in some way, and initially the mind resists, right? That little monkey mind does not want to change. Or it's learned a different way of being, you know, it's learned how to do midline activation, and it isn't easy to change. And then they give up too soon. They give up too soon. You know, if we want to change the mind and change the brain, we have to practice. Which means that whatever benefits we get are really legitimate. We've earned them. All right. So one question, then I'll move on. Yeah.
You mentioned doing this in a meeting, in a business meeting.
Oh. Yeah.
Now, I can think of some very highly stressful circumstances in which being able to bring your mind down would be very beneficial. Does it take away, to what extent does it take away from your ability to focus on the task?
Yeah. Okay, so question about using a practice like this, open spacious awareness in a business meeting, reducing your productivity or in anything, in any kind of situation. I think open, if you're doing something like, you know, if you're in a heated, friendly argument with a friend, right, or you're playing tennis, I don't think open spacious awareness is, you know, exactly what you want to do. On the other hand, to be able to drop into that sense of the whole, or to drop into the big bird's eye view that includes everything and is not partial to anything. In other words, is not resisting what's unpleasant or chasing after and getting hooked on what's pleasant. Boy, if only for a moment, that's instant stress relief. That's a moment of refuge, a moment of sanctuary, of quiet and clarity. And then often from that bigger picture place, we become actually more productive. There's been a lot of work done these days around mindfulness in the workplace, right? And in which people are realizing, including in corporate America, that workers who are more able to step out of the intensity of a task or the intensity of a discussion into more of a big picture perspective are actually better workers. Also, they get less stress, they have less health insurance claims, and they stay on the job longer. That's good stuff. Okay, I'm going to keep going. All right. Taking in the good. Now that there's some growing capacity, which will keep growing, right, because you're going to keep practicing, to get control of that spotlight and vacuum cleaner, what in the world do we want to suck into the brain? This is an important question because one of the results of evolution, alas, is that it looks for bad news. And then when it finds it, it super sucks it into the brain. The brain really is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. So how did that happen, and what can we do about it? All right, that's what this section's on. So to put this in context, I want to say here that you'll see these three themes in many parts of the world, both in terms of Buddhism, the three pillars of practice here, as well as in other contemplative traditions, and also in Western psychology or any discussion of the good life. This basic idea, by one word or another, that being able to pay attention and be aware, second, being of good character, and third, being wise, are really at the heart of the good life. I think it's no accident that these are universal pillars of the good life because they map well to the three fundamental functions of the nervous system. The first function being attending and learning, right? Second function being regulation. Regulating maps very well to virtue. In other words, finding a good set point and then staying within range, right? And restraining excesses. That's virtue very much. And then less wisdom, selecting or prioritizing. The heart of wisdom is choosing a greater good over a lesser one. It's easy to choose good over bad. The tricky thing is to choose a long-term good over a long-term big good over a short-term medium good or small good, right? That's tough, okay? So now, these kind of map to what I think of as the three great phases of whether it's psychological healing, or self-actualization, or spiritual practice, which is to say, first phase, we're aware of what's there, all right? We're mindful of it. And let's say it's something painful, something difficult, something wrenching or upsetting, or what's there in the mind is anger, or what's there in the mind is fear, let's say. We need to, first of all, be with it. We've got to stay with it. We have to have some spaciousness around it. That alone is often enough, right? And that alone also builds up the neural substrate of open spacious mindfulness. So it's a two for benefit, right? But often it's not enough. I think mindfulness has gotten overrated in psychology and in Buddhism in the West, and there's now a growing corrective going the other way. But someone as big on mindfulness as the Buddha, who has right mindfulness as one of the eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, also has right effort, which means pulling weeds and planting flowers in the garden of the mind, which means the brain. So that takes us to the second and third phase, where we release what's problematic. Past the point of productivity, since neurons that fire together wire together, if we're just hanging out with painful material with no particular benefit, it's like running another lap in hell. And every time we lap around the track, we dig the trail one little bit deeper. Because neurons that fire together wire together for better or worse. All right? So we need to let go of what's there. We need to release it. And then in the third great phase, we need to replace it. All right? All three are important. Sometimes what people need to do is jump to the third phase to internalize resources, which then can enable them to do the first phase, to bear their experience, to stay with it, to be mindful of it. Some people are really good at one phase or another. Maybe not coincidentally, because I'm a guy, I didn't like that first phase. I wanted the solution phase. Number two, get rid of that stuff. Pain, out. You know, upset, go away. Right? And I had to learn with practice and so forth to hang out more in the first phase, which really is the foundation for the other two. On the other hand, I've known a lot of people who get stuck in the first phase. They can be mindful of it, and they're mindful of it, and they're in it, and often not very spaciously, and they're doing another lap in hell. All right. So I'm going to focus here on the third phase. How do we replace, how do we take in the good that replaces the bad? I don't mean morally, I mean pragmatically, in terms of what promotes happiness and benefit compared to what creates suffering and harm. That's what I mean by good. How do we do that? All right? And we've got a challenge because we're not hardwired to do this. So if you think about evolution, right? Been around a long time, 3.5 billion years of life, 650 million years roughly, multi-celled organisms. When I get a cold, sometimes I think those bugs have a 3 billion year head start, right? Nervous system evolving about 600 million years. You know, mammals, primates, early humans, tool users. How many of you have blue eyes or green eyes? Raise your hand. Be proud. You're mutants. Mutants. I'm old stock, you know, brown eyes, you know. Nobody had brown, blue eyes until about 5,000 years ago. Some little kid born in around in Denmark, you know, came out with blue eyes. And that particular kid, other kids may have had blue eyes or green eyes, what have you, but that kid had a lot of great-grandchildren. And some of you are sitting in this room. All right? Evolution is ongoing. All right, during that long run, there were three main stages, which correspond basically to three layers of the brain, loosely. We have the reptilian layer, the early squirrel rat layer, which came in, you know, during Jurassic Park. I have a lot of respect for and admiration for our ancient rat ancestors scurrying around, those velociraptors and T-Rexes and brontosauruses thought they were so hot, didn't they? Right? But our little rat-like ancestors, you know, they were cool. They were the quick and not the dead, right? 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs disappeared. And we're sitting here in the room today. So I have a lot of affinity for rats and squirrels, you know. Anyway. Okay, so during this long run, whoop, you know, three fundamental motivational systems evolved. The first one that corresponds to the reptilian brain is this avoid system that freezes, that stops, that just like that. One layer up, we have a development of the attaching system, which, including with various reptiles or that large group that encompasses reptiles, was also present, in which there's more sophisticated ramping up of bodily systems to go after rewards with more sophisticated regulation of breathing, heart rate, and so forth. And then came the mammalian and avian species, who started developing this attach system, which bonds, which raises young and forms pair bonds, which really matured in the primates, you know, the most social group of species on the planet, and really, really, super really matured in human beings, who are the most sociable, most social species of all. All right, so we have these three systems, right? Okay, I just talked about this one. All right, so we have these three systems. Now we have the negativity bias, because even though it's really important to go get rewards, go approach those carrots,
We also have to avoid those sticks. From the standpoint of evolution, it's more important to avoid sticks than get carrots. If you don't get a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance of a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, avoid that. If you don't avoid that predator, you don't avoid that social aggression in your band or between bands, or you don't avoid that falling tree, whap, no more carrots forever. All right? So we have a negativity bias, you know, in which things that are urgent, right, and have massive impact really have to be paid attention to. For example, people of all kinds, rat people and human people, learn typically much more quickly from punishment, from pain, than they do from rewards or pleasure. Because, you know, if you don't learn how to get a carrot at first, you'll have more at-bats. You'll have more chances to get that carrot. But if you do manage to avoid that stick once, you may not get a second chance. You better learn the very first time how to get away from that tiger, or what a tiger's, you know, cough sounds like as it approaches, you know, your cave. Right? Okay. So, I'm going to flip through a fair number of slides that I'm going to send to you. Actually, I'll make a point here because it's worth making a point. One of the major aspects of the negativity bias is threat reactivity. It's where we become very alert to the sense that there's a tiger there. Now, there are two kinds of mistakes you can make, right? You can, you know, think there's a tiger in the bushes, but there's really no tiger. Coast is clear. Or you could think everything's fine, no problem, just another day at the beach. Whap! There really is a tiger there. Mother Nature wants us to make the first mistake 1,000 times over to avoid making the second mistake even once. And this hardwired evolutionary tendency is then amplified by personal temperament. Some people are more anxious than others constitutionally. And then by life experiences. Then by modern culture, which jacks up the nervous system, which is primed to read threats. So just being busy and active tends to make us more threat reactive. And then in the story that's been told 1,000 times or more in history, you know, you have various political groups who intensify a sense of inner or outer enemies, inner or outer threats, as a way to justify greater authoritarian control. Okay? So that leads to, you know, three mistakes. We overestimate threats, we underestimate opportunities, and we underestimate resources inside and outside ourselves. And you see this issue individually, in a couple, in a family, in a company, and among nations.
And we think it's just a tea party.
Thank you. We will not do politics from the front, from the podium here. All right? So that gives us a poignant truth, right? Mother Nature is tilted toward gene copies. She's really good at passing on gene copies at the cost, alas, of being tilted against quality of life. All right? And what do we do about it, right? What are we going to do? To me, one thing to do is to take up arms against our oppressors, most of whom live inside our head. We sleep with the enemy every night, right between our ears. All right? How do we grab hold of this caveman, cavewoman tendency that's great at passing on grandchildren, right? How do we take hold of it and lead to a better quality of life over the long haul? What can we do? We can use the mind to change the brain for the better, and one of the best ways, and one of my favorite ways, is to take in the good. So we did a little taste of taking in the good at the very end of that meditative practice where I said register the experience of open, spacious mindfulness, really get what it feels like, and sense that it's sinking into you. All right? So you've already done this a little bit. Before I do this method with you, let me just explain the difference between implicit and explicit memory. Anytime you're building structure in the brain, that's memory. That's learning and memory. Most of the structure building that occurs through living is in implicit memory, which has to do with the emotional residues of lived experience, how to do things, innate sort of presumptions, assumptions, you know, biases in one direction or another. That's an implicit memory. Explicit memory is recollections of specific events, like what you did or didn't do for breakfast this morning, right? Because you hadn't yet heard Jan's advice and you had, you know, three donuts and, you know, four shots of espresso and a glass of red wine. And now you're ready to rock and roll. Okay, anyway. My friends will laugh at me after a long day of rock climbing, which I've done a lot. I'd roll into the bar. That's the key. You got to get to the bar before dark, right? But anyway, and I'd say a big glass of water, a cup of coffee, and a beer, you know, because I need to regulate all my different levels, you know. Okay, so The point here is to really, really help the brain rather than being like Velcro for negative experiences, right? The brain instantly registers negative experiences. Maybe you go through the day, 100 things happen in the day, right? 50 are neutral, 49 are mildly pleasant, because most of experiences ranges from mildly pleasant to mildly unpleasant. 49 are mildly pleasant and one was unpleasant, all right? You're worried about something or something happened. What's the one out of 100 you think about falling asleep? Right? Because that's the one that, you know, Mother Nature wants you to think about. So it's through consciously, deliberately intensifying positive experiences, staying with them and helping them fill the body, that we get normal memory systems really working, really wiring together, so they really firing together, so they wire that positive resource into the fabric of the brain and the being. Any single time a person uses this method usually will not change their life, but it's just as the gradual accumulation of negative experiences tilts us increasingly toward a glum mood, pessimism, feelings of inadequacy, you know, paper tiger paranoia, missing, you know, mistrust for other people. In the same way, the growing accumulation of positive experiences based on deliberately taking in the good will gradually incline our mind in a better way toward more optimism, more self-worth, more happiness, more loving kindness, more capacities to take care of ourselves and other people. So let's try this, okay? And I'll do this in a couple of different ways with you. For starters, just pick some good fact. This is not the power of positive thinking. This is focused on facts, all right? Genuine, objectively legitimate facts. Good news, real good news. So pick some positive fact. It could be something pleasant that's happened to you recently, or some accomplishment, maybe a nice thing someone did for you or to you, maybe just simply the beautiful view here, or the opportunity to sit here with good people and learn hopefully good things. And then as you are aware of that good fact, with your eyes open or closed, let it become a good experience. So often we go through life, good things have happened, and the needle does not move. It's like preparing a meal, setting it before you, and then eating it with a toothpick, right? But instead, if you've earned a good fact, or a good fact has just been handed to you on a silver platter, bring a big spoon. Right? So you want to let yourself right now feel this good fact, let it become an experience. It's fine if the experience is fairly mild, although it may feel very pervading. And then in the second step, really let it become as big and lasting and as intense as possible. It's perfectly natural for it to crumble and then come back. It's even natural for the opposite negative experience sometimes to come up. But this is a mindfulness practice. This is a concentration practice, technically. Get control of that spotlight and bring it back to the positive experience and let it rest there. And then in the third step, as you sink into this experience, sense and intend that it is sinking into you. Maybe visualizing it going in like water into a sponge, or a golden light, or a golden balm, a soothing syrup going in. Or maybe just know somehow that this experience is becoming a part of you, a resource you can take with you wherever you go. Okay, come on back. And it's okay to continue feeling good, because as you feel good, those neurons are firing together and therefore wiring together, all right? Most of the time when we do taking in the good, we'll do it on the fly in daily life. Things happen, we just slow down for 10, 20, 30 seconds to be with it, to really enjoy it, and to sense and intend that it's really sinking in, opening up the body to let in the heart and the mind to really let it sink in. Additionally, it's great to have specific times in a day where one takes in the good.
Whether it's with kids just before bedtime, ages typically 3 to 13, who will put up with some psychobabble to extend their bedtime, you can encourage them to take in good things from the end of the day. Or adults doing something like the Three Blessings practice, which research has shown is amazingly effective, where you just think about three things that you're glad about. It gets turbocharged if you do a little writing about them and do them just before sleep. As someone told me, Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits several centuries ago, said that of all the practices you do, whatever they are, if you have to give them all up except one, keep doing the one you do just before sleep. He was a neuroscientist. You know, Proust was a neuroscientist, right? Ignatius Loyola was a neuroscientist, too, in a very practical way. Okay? So, the point here is just having positive experiences is not enough. They normally just flow through the brain like water through a sieve. Alas, the sieve catches every bit of negativity, but it lets the positive stuff flow through. The trick is to really engage the mind deliberately, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, to really get those neurons firing and therefore wiring together. Okay, targets of taking in the good, these are four different types. Bodily states that are positive, different emotions that are positive, viewpoints, even behavioral repertoire or tendencies or inclinations. You might think to yourself, you know, what's a key resource for me? In other words, here we're talking about building resources, inner resources, inside the brain and the self. What would be some key resources for me? What do I really need? What's my personal vitamin C? You know, if you've got scurvy, you can give yourself tons and tons of protein or vitamin D or some of those esoteric gobbledygook, you know, things that Jan was talking about, and that won't do a darn thing. They're good for other purposes, right? But if you've got scurvy, you need vitamin C. What's your vitamin C for your own kind of scurvy, all right? So I've put here several different kinds of good to take in. They're clustered in terms of the approaching system first, the avoiding system second, and the attaching system third, and then a fourth cluster that's nonspecific, including one of my favorite ones, just recognizing your own positive character traits, your own natural goodness, for example, okay? And again, you might think to yourself, which one of those three systems, these days especially, is most troubled for me? In other words, do I have key issues around safety and fear and feeling threatened or being angry? Or do I have key issues around feeling, that's the avoiding system, or in terms of the approaching system, do I have key issues around feeling thwarted, frustrated, disappointed, I'm not attaining my goals, I'm not satisfied, I don't feel fulfilled? Or are there key issues around the attaching system in terms of feeling abandoned, devalued, not seen, not appreciated, and so forth? And then think, maybe those are my key resources for taking in the good. All right? So let's do another practice here. If you like, pick one of those. Okay? Pick one of those. We'll do this twice, so you have two chances here. Pick one, maybe one that you think especially, you look at it and you go, yeah, that one's really important for me. That's a supply that I really need. Okay? So pick one, and then in the first step of the three steps of taking in the good, let yourself actually have an experience related to that good. So, for example, the small pleasures of everyday life, pick something that you know is pleasurable even right now, you know, or was recently pleasurable, and then let it become an experience. That's the first step. So in the first step, you're opening to a positive experience. And then in the second step, you are encouraging it to last as long as possible. You're staying with this positive experience and even gently helping it intensify, if it will, and if it will, spread throughout your body. And then in the third step, all the while, sensing and intending that it's sinking into you, soaking into you, like the warmth from a cup of hot cocoa soaking into your hands. Okay, come on back. Any questions or difficulties with the method? Yeah. Okay, so two issues here in the question. One is how to pick a clear target, right? A key, you know, rather than jumping around from a lot of them. And then second, how to allow a good fact to become a good experience. Right there is very interesting, isn't it? And this illustrates a general principle, which is that very often we think, oh, okay, I ought to try something. It would be good for me to do it. It makes sense. We try it, and we hit an obstruction. Like maybe right off the top. Huh, very interesting. Maybe it's hard for me to actually have a good experience. Or maybe I think that it might be vain, or it's actually frightening to let myself feel good, because then I'll lower my guard, and that's whap when they'll really get you. You know, I'm not saying that's true here. I'm listing some possible obstructions. So then you work on the obstruction, and then you come back to the key thing. I find that a good way to work this is around physical pleasure. You have to really damage your brain. So that it cannot feel pleasure. Whatever is physically pleasurable for you, whether it's a, don't listen, Jan, whether it's a chocolate, you know, drop, whatever those things are, chocolate chip, there we go, or having your back scratched, or, you know, glass of water on a hot day, etc. Whatever is physically pleasurable, you're registering that, then let yourself have a pleasant experience related to it. All right. So the way to do it is you're just slowing down. Normally, we do have positive experiences, all right, because that's how Mother Nature rewards us. She wants us to do those things that get those carrots, for example. We're built to have positive experiences. Mother Nature's on our side. Very often, the way to have them is to slow down and let them arrive. All right. And I would start on something simple and powerful, you know, that you know always makes you feel good. Like, gratitude is a good one, too, besides physical pleasure. Like, I think about, you know, things that make me happy. I think about my kids, wham, I feel happy. Our kids, you know. Or I think about Tuolumne Meadows, spent a lot of time there. I'm happy. That's what I do when I'm in the dentist chair. Ooh, you know, I'm in Tuolumne Meadows. It's the best I can do. It's a concentration practice. And that's also where I appreciate, you know, years of meditating, that I can stay in Tuolumne Meadows even as they're doing their thing. Okay. All right, one more, then I better keep going.
Missed a little bit for this, the area to concentrate on. Is this one that comes to us very easily and naturally, or are we focusing on an area where our little buttons get pushed and we want to?
Great question. Yeah, so the question is, if you're doing these right now in this practice, do you go after something easy or something that's maybe harder to experience, but you know it's your vitamin C, right? And I would say do either way. I kind of encouraged you to go after the vitamin C, but if you're having any difficulty, go with something's easy. What you want to do here is learn the method. You want to learn these three steps. Okay? So in the interest of time, I'm actually going to move on under this general heading, the whole idea of the fourth step. This is the optional step of taking in the good, and this is a key way to heal old pain. Basically what we do is we're aware of two things at once. We're mostly centered in the positive experience while simultaneously getting a sense that it's making contact with some place of old pain. Right? If you get sucked into old pain, drop it. Don't do the fourth step. Go back to the third one. It's also possible to take in, just without consciously accessing old pain, resources that you know are particularly important for you. All right. Maybe as a kid, for whatever reason, you had lots of experiences of people not really listening to you or being interested in you or kind of getting you. So today, if you have those kinds of experiences, that's your vitamin C. On the other hand, maybe you had as a kid lots of experiences, or in your last job or your last marriage, of powerlessness, right? Of lack of autonomy, of being controlled, of being intrusively invaded by other people.
Well, these days then, if you have experiences of autonomy, of efficacy, of being the cue ball instead of the eight ball, really, really soak that in. All right. This takes us to the notion of psychological antidotes. And we could spend a day on this one. I'll do this kind of quickly. In other words, if you think about it, based on what was missing, there's something particularly that will be a helpful supply. Or based on something that was particularly wounding, there will be something that's a particularly beneficial balm or soothing salve or resource. For example, as I said, if you have felt unloved, you know, obviously, experiences of connection, even if they're not million-dollar moments, even if it's simply the guy at the deli who's making you a sandwich, you know, guy or gal, whatever, that's an opportunity to take in a key resource. You know, if you think about it, you know, you might look at this list right here and ask yourself, what's a key issue for me these days? And then identify a key supply. You know, for me, you know, some of you heard me tell the story, I'll be brief about it. You know, growing up, for various reasons, including going through school really young, I had this sense of being on the other side of a wall of glass of people in general, and not really included or valued by other people. And so then when I kind of started thinking about taking in the good in my 20s, I thought, wow, what a great idea, you know? Even though the hole in my heart felt like as big as a construction site, brick by brick, a few times every day, when there was a genuine opportunity to feel included, to feel wanted, to feel sought, to feel valued, that I could let that fact become a key experience, which then I could sense was going down into those old places inside that were hurt. Even visualizing little Ricky inside, who was finally getting what he always needed. Right. Most of us know deep down what our own unique hole in the heart is, our own particular, it may not be unique, but our own particular hole in the heart is, and what our own vitamin C is. And if you are clear about that, then you can really help yourself by going through the day looking for that supply. You know, you can even do things, hopefully skillful, in which you particularly go after that supply. Like in my 20s especially, it was kind of a joke among my friends. They might say something like, "Oh, that was good what you said in the meeting." And then I'd reply sometimes, "Oh yeah? Thank you. What'd you like about it?" You know, I admit it, some of the time I did it like, "Shoot me up with more praise, please, now, feed me some more." No. But most of the time, I knew I was taking it in to build it up inside, so I was less dependent on it being out there. That's where unconditional happiness comes in. We're more and more happy, not based on conditions, right? The eight worldly winds may come and blow in any kind of way, but our happiness is based on internalized factors, including a deep wisdom. Okay, so moving along. All right. I like this line. Sometimes people feel it's not okay to take in the good, as if it's vain and selfish and therefore bad and so forth. But as Bertrand Russell said, also backed up by tons of resource, basically the good life is a happy one because happy people are good people. Typically when people feel their own cup runneth over, then they tend to be more forbearing, kinder, more generous, and so forth toward others. Okay? Love and loving. All right? Are you okay? Feeling good? You know, moving along here? All right? Okay. So, I love this quote. Actually, I went through this already, basically about the ways in which love arguably has been the main driving force of the evolution of the brain over the last 80 million years, especially the last 55 million years. You know, if you think about it, the early makers of tools, 2.5 million years ago, had brains about a third our size. The brain has tripled in volume about over the last 3 million years. Much of that build-out is for social capacities. In other words, the quote-unquote reproductive advantages, I always love that phrase, you know, "Hey, baby, you want to advantage my reproduction?" You know, but anyway, the reproductive advantages, that's the engine of biological evolution. Right, the reproductive advantages of social skills, broadly defined, really enabled different hunter-gatherer groups early hominid groups that mainly bred in, within the group and competed between groups, all right? Groups that had better teamwork, groups that had tighter bonding between parents and kids and between parents and parents and among the members of the tribe, you know, the village it takes to raise a child, those tribes outcompeted tribes that were more individualistic, less caring, less empathic, and less loving back there on the Serengeti.
I think it's really cool to appreciate that it's not violence, it's not, you know, hate, if you will, that really has driven the evolution of the brain. All right. Darwin has this wonderful line, Darwin had serious game. You know, our son went to this retreat once at a Biagiri monastery in Northern California, and after his time there, he came back. He was about 16, kind of a hardcore kind of kid, in good ways. And so I said, Forrest, what did you think about, you know, what was it like up there? And he said, you know, well, you know, but you know, Dad, those Ajahns have game. Ajahn is an honorific, you know, like father or rabbi or whatever, you know, Ajahn. Those Ajahns have game. Anyway, I think Darwin had a lot of game, as well as the Ajahns, but this is a great quote here. So, you know, it's important to appreciate that when we're kind to ourselves, then we have more capacities for others. You know, the Buddha here is echoing what Bertrand Russell said, you know, a few slides back. Or as they say in the airlines, right, put your own oxygen mask on first. So if we are interested in feeling loved and being loving, which use overlapping neural circuitry and have obviously great benefit, how can we actually do that? And that takes us to self-compassion. Self-compassion is a major area of research these days. A lot of the seeming benefits of self-esteem boil down to benefits of self-compassion. It buffers stress, increases resilience and self-worth. It feels good as well. But it's actually hard for a lot of people. They will be kind, they will be compassionate toward others, but not particularly for themselves. All right? Compassion at bottom is a wish. It's a wish that a being not suffer. Kindness, technically, is the wish that the being be happy. They obviously overlap, all right? But I'm going to focus here mainly on the wish that this pain pass and may you know peace. So let's do a practice here that's neurologically designed to make it easier to enter a state of self-compassion. Okay? So, first of all, as you can, bring to mind the sense of being with someone that you know cares about you. It could be someone in your life these days. It could be a pet, an animal companion. It could be the natural world. It could be a spirit entity, a guardian angel, God, if that's meaningful for you. It also could be someone from your past, a being from your past, like a relative, a grandparent, a coach, a teacher, someone who you know in your heart you matter to. They wish you well. They wish that you not suffer. They care about you. And then based on that, based on the fact, if you will, of someone caring about you, let that become an experience of feeling cared about. If other experiences arise, like feeling not cared about, feeling hurt or wounded, that's okay. Let them come and go like clouds in that big sky of awareness. And then come back as a concentration practice. Bring that spotlight back to the experience of feeling cared about. Be mindful of what it's like in your body, in your emotions, in your thoughts, to feel cared about. Second, staying in touch with the feeling of being cared about, although it may settle it more into the background, bring to mind someone you naturally feel compassion for. You naturally wish that they not suffer. They move your heart. Could be someone in your life, could be a child in a newspaper ad
for some nonprofit who lives 10,000 miles away. It could be a pet. You might encourage the experience of compassion with phrases softly in the back of your mind, like, "May you not suffer. May you be at peace. May this pain pass." Sometimes you can strengthen the sense of compassion with a hand on the heart or on your cheek through what's called embodied cognition. Be mindful of compassion. What's it like as an experience in the body, in the emotions, in the mind? And then, staying grounded in the experience of compassion, apply it to yourself as a little child. Maybe a picture of yourself from a photograph as a little kid, or a sense of the little child inside you, vulnerable, innocent, not perfect, snotty-nosed sometimes, but sweet, really deserving of compassion. Maybe thinking about some tough times for yourself as a child, you know, bringing compassion to that today. And then finally, as you can, staying with a feeling of compassion, bring compassion to yourself these days. Maybe aware of challenges you face, difficulties you have, perhaps combined with thoughts like, "May I not suffer? May I be all right?" May I be at ease. One back. Sometimes people think they have to be perfect to deserve compassion, you know. No, as Leonard Cohen says, we're all cracked. It's how the light gets in, you know. Okay. Any question or comment about this practice? Oh, yeah?
Two, briefly. One is that it's still hard to feel that self-compassion. And the other is, at the end, immediately gratitude just started popping right up.
Great. All right, she said, compassion's still hard. At the end, gratitude popped up. I think a lot of what we do when we practice is we're trying to build out slots on the motherboard, in a sense. And we're trying to create more capacity or room for key experiences, key resources, you know. And that's what we're doing. And sometimes it just takes practice. We come back to it. But what's great about this stuff about loved and loving is that it's our nature. You know, our nature is to have compassion, right, including for ourselves. So something's obstructing the expression of that. But at least Mother Nature's on our side, and we have that capacity and even inclination in the first place. Yeah. Okay. Maybe one more person, then I'll move on. Yeah, all the way in the back.
Yeah, I'm wondering what you think about how our
children with ADHD and, you know, things like that, perhaps, in terms of the interaction with parents and children.
Okay, so I'm not totally sure I get the comment slash question, but if I think I do, essentially you're asking about temperament, really, particularly extremes in a sense of normal temperament. In other words, either at the jackrabbit end of the temperamental spectrum or the turtle end. I don't think those are pathologies. I think those are normal adaptations, because if you think back on tribes evolving or bands evolving in the Serengeti, bands that were mono temperament could not compete that well with other bands that had some turtles, some jackrabbits, some turtles, and a lot of tweeners. Right? In other words, bands with mixed types did better against bands of just jackrabbits, just turtles, or just tweeners, which is a great way to think about, you know, jackrabbititis, which we now medicate and call a pathology. From a pragmatic standpoint, it's tough to be a jackrabbit, particularly a real jumpy jackrabbit, who would be on the fast track to be, you know, headhunter, head shaman of the tribe, you know, 20,000 years ago. These days, you know, sent to the principal's office routinely. But that said, I don't think of it as a pathology. I think of it as a pragmatic problem. And people who are experiencing a fair amount of bumps and bruises in life, typically at either end of the temperamental spectrum, jackrabbits or turtles, especially need self-compassion. You know, if you think about it, being a jackrabbit's tough, and if you're a turtle, you're kind of scared a lot, and you often tend to be kind of rigid. You also need some self-compassion, because you're taking shots, you're taking hits in life. Okay. I'm not going to talk about empathy particularly, although I could. I just want to say in passing that there are three fundamental neural subsystems that do empathy. One simulates, empathy essentially means we simulate the inner world of others. So we can simulate the actions of others. That's where the mirror-like networks come in. We can simulate the emotions of others. That's where the insula comes in that I spoke of earlier, where we track the feelings of other people. And we can simulate the thoughts, broadly defined, of other people. All three are important. I think even though mirror neurons and mirror-like networks have gotten a lot of news attention, simulating the actions of others, in most cases, is really the least important of the three in terms of empathy. And where empathy really, you know, is critical is in terms of tracking the feelings and the life of the mind in other people. That's useful not just in romantic relationships, but also in dealing with customers, prospects, coworkers, parents, you know. As they say in spiritual practice, you think you're enlightened? Go home for the holidays. Yeah. Okay. So, skills for empathy, show up, and then play around with these three systems, you know, tuning into the actions of others, what are the intentions behind their actions, tune into the feelings of others by opening up to your own feelings. That gets the insula active. It's kind of two birds, one stone, you know, double benefit there. And also track thoughts, sense beneath the surface, or what I call, you know, get a sense of the being behind the eyes. You know, that inner person over there who's having a real experience, whose life is tough, who suffers, who will one day die, like we all will, and get a sense of what it's really like to be that person behind the eyes. Okay, I love this line here from Longfellow. You know, people we're in conflict with, including difficult people, truly, if we had a sense of the being behind the eyes, you know, we would appreciate, their inner life, and it would be hard to call them enemy. We might call them adversary. We might say, you know, you need to act differently, or I may need to put you out of my company, my office, my bed, but I will not put you out of my heart. Because if we're all in touch with transience, impermanence, symbolized here metaphorically by the cherry blossom, so transient, so evanescent, you know, in the shade of the cherry blossom, you know, no one is a stranger. We're all transient, right? We're all eddies in the stream. We're all bubbles just waiting to pop. Right? And knowing that about other people can really breed both compassion and empathy. All right. So, one thing? Yeah. Yeah.
I'm finding, that it's hard in a society, if you are an empathetic person, not to have people come at you and say, oh, you're too generous, or you're, and having that constantly mirrored at you and having you doubt your instincts about either people or situation.
Yeah.
Then starts to turn you on yourself, and I don't know how to deflect that and just stay true to what I'm, you know?
Yeah, comment about if a person has a big heart and is very giving and generous and so forth, sometimes other people can look at that and say, suck. Right, essentially, in a nutshell. And how do you stay in touch with yourself? How do you have confidence in yourself and stay the course? And I think embedded in that as well is how do you balance assertiveness and kindness? And so two things. One, I think it's useful to see the results, right? Just clear seeing. You know, whether it's science or business or spiritual life, you know, the root source of suffering is ignorance. You know, and the truth is what sets us free, right? So I think seeing clearly, am I being taken advantage of, or is it really working just fine? Right? Second, I think that there's a place for, as I said recently in my sitting group, being firm in the beginning helps us be kind in the end. In other words, being assertive in the beginning is a good foundation for kindness. And if you have any interest in it, and I was going to mention it later, I'll just say it right now, a week from today, I think, at Spirit Rock, October 2nd, I'm teaching a workshop there with Fred Luskin, who is Mr. Forgiveness at Stanford, and we're going to do a workshop called Forgiveness Assertiveness, because both really are important. So I think both are really important. You know, centered in kindness, grounded in some quality of equanimity, it's the best possible way or place from which to speak truth to power. They both go together. Okay? I'm going to keep moving. These last two points are more familiar, or this one is particularly familiar, so I'll kind of move fairly rapidly through this one. Of these Rick's five keys, you know, I think that this one is a very important one. It has to do with the fact that we evolved to handle short-term bursts of acute stress, but we did not evolve to handle chronic, mild stress, which is the daily diet. And certainly we did not evolve to handle that and wanting to live well into the 80s or 90s. I'm going to go visit with Jan, my dad, later today, who's 91 and a half, who has a new lady friend, all right? 91 is the new 71, you know, ooh la la, baby. And so, you know, we want to live long and prosper, right? At a time when everybody was dead by their 35th birthday, or most people were, it didn't really matter what the long-term effects of chronic stress were. But if we want to live long and well, it really, really does matter. Okay, so there is a place for negative experiences, right? Sorrow tenderizes the heart, you know, remorse keeps us on the straight and narrow. But really, is there any shortage of negative experiences? Would you like some of my negative experiences because you don't have enough? Really, I never get a taker, all right? Okay, never ever do I get a taker for that one. Because, you know, chronic stress is very bad for us, physically and mentally. Neurologically, I'll skip through this slide because this one's probably fairly familiar to people. Bottom line, stress is bad, all right? That's the takeaway from that slide. One thing it can do inside the brain is that you've got this brain, it's got, let's say, an alarm bell, that's the amygdala, and then it has the hippocampus, which does visual spatial memory and memory for context, and also puts the brakes on the alarm bell and puts the brakes on stress hormones, notably cortisol. The problem, as the slide says, is that stress today, cortisol today, both sensitizes the alarm bell and weakens the amygdala. Weakens the hippocampus, that's what I meant to say. It sensitizes the amygdala, weakens the hippocampus, and that makes us more reactive to stress tomorrow, right? Which does the same thing in a vicious cycle so that the day after tomorrow, we're more sensitive than ever. That's why I think it's really important when we, as soon as we start thinking, or feeling, oh, jacked up or revved up in that problematic degree. You know, the stress needle, right? Green, chartreuse, yellow, orange, and red. As soon as it starts moving into yellow or in orange, and definitely if it starts hitting the red zone, boom, mount a calming, soothing response. And that has to do with the parasympathetic nervous system. Basically, in terms of managing stress or managing daily life, we have these two systems that are connected like a seesaw, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. As we get activated around stress, the fight or flight stress response sympathetic system activates, suppressing the parasympathetic system. On the other hand, if we activate the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest nervous system, it downregulates the sympathetic nervous system. Most people,
I admit it, me included, are in a state of chronic sympathetic overdrive, including from just working really hard. Long hours, juggling lots of tasks, you know, doing emails, raising kids, driving around, all this stuff, that's sympathetic activation. Being upset activates the sympathetic nervous system. Being irritated, being anxious, being really blue, all of that activates the sympathetic nervous system. That's why I think doing things deliberately to mount, as Jan Kitt's saying very well, a cooling response, cool the fires, calm things down, settle down, is so important these days. One of the key ways to do that is to feel as safe as you reasonably can. Remember paper tiger paranoia? Remember threat reactivity? Remember how we evolved to see tigers everywhere? That means we don't feel safe. A few people need to get more worried. Right? Our son needs to worry more about what it means when he gets a letter from the court, traffic court, you know? He needs to worry a little more when red lights go on his dashboard of his car. He's 22. Okay, but most people are more worried than they really need to be. Most people feel less safe than they reasonably can. So let's do a practice here about feeling as safe as you reasonably can. All right? So now for some people, it's alarming to feel safer because that's when you lower your guard and you get whapped. So be careful with yourself here. You know, and if you use these practices with others, keep that in mind. That said, if you like, bring to mind a sense of this, of your own, some of your own strengths. Maybe just literally a physical feeling in your body of strength. Maybe recalling the body memory of lifting weights or going on a long walk or really coming through for other people. Maybe protecting somebody. What's that feel like in your body, that sense of strength? You might remind yourself of some of the resources in your life, both inside you, determination, will, endurance, just surviving, yeah? Just knowing that you're still here, that you finally walked away from the train wreck of fill in the blank, your childhood, your last marriage, your last job, your last home, what have you. Also bring to mind a sense of being right now in a protected setting, among good people, such that you can explore what it's like to lower your guard. What it's like to feel less braced against life. What it's like to feel less vigilant. Explore the sense that you've escaped, you've crossed over to safety, the war is over. To the extent you do have a growing sense of strength and a growing sense of safety, take in that good. Take a moment to be really mindful of that experience and sense and intend that it's sinking in.
Come on back. As always, it's fine to keep feeling good to the extent that you have. Any quick question or comment about safety? Yeah, great, Mark.
A couple of things. The last two exercises where we were meditating on safety and also feeling good about myself, that I had to go through the doorway of feeling more intense feelings and sensations as energy to allow that to be present. So there's an increase in capacity, kind of dialogue capacity.
Mark was sharing that for him to access a greater self-compassion, feeling good about himself or self-compassion, and also access a growing sense of safety, he had to actually go through more energy, more in the body, maybe more intensity, and so forth. And what's great is he had the capacity to do that, maybe drawing on resources like that open, spacious mindfulness. Other people, sometimes what happens is they hit those and they are an obstruction, right? They can't access self-compassion or they can't access a growing sense of safety. And then, okay, that's fine. That's totally okay. It's not that they're resisting. It's just that there's an obstruction. So then we deal with the obstruction, including, for example, related to safety, really going through the list of why it's okay to feel, why it's reasonable to feel a little safer. Right. A key thing here, I'll just keep going if I could, is with regard to generally activating the parasympathetic nervous system, I want to mention a couple of go-tos. One is to do long exhalations. That activates the parasympathetic nervous system. Someone gave me a great idea a little earlier about whistling. You know, whistling forces long exhalations. You know, a lot of these things are, you know, these are tried and true methods, but now we understand increasingly why they work, you know. Another good method is to relax the tongue or fiddle the lips. You want to do it with me? One, two, three. See, besides the absurdity of it all, you're probably getting some parasympathetic benefit because the rest and digest system has nerve fibers that just fill the mouth. Okay? And so now on the home stretch here, I want to move into the last section, followed by a little practice, and then Jen and I will, you know, open it up more to general questions and discussion. So what's interesting is to ask oneself, what's the nature of the brain, or what's the nature of a person in a peak state? Because then we can do reverse engineering. We can think, okay, that's the nature of the brain when I'm happy, or feeling strong, or feeling safe, or self-actualizing, or having samadhi, or deep spiritual experiences, or, hey, going all the way to enlightenment. You know, an enlightened person doesn't not have a brain, right? They still have a brain. The question is, what's its mode of functioning? So if you think about it, we have these three motivational systems. We've talked about these before: avoid, approach, and attach. And in terms of the home base of the human brain, in other words, when people in general are not hungry, not in pain, not upset, not biochemically disturbed upstairs because they haven't followed Janie's advice, which I try to do much of the time. No, more than much of the time. Anyway, the avoid system defaults to a state of calm. Parasympathetic activation is more fundamental than sympathetic activation. If you sever the nerve tracts of the sympathetic nervous system, the person will stay alive. If you cut the nerve tracts of the parasympathetic nervous system, person will keel over, stop breathing, the heart will stop beating, they'll die. Right? Second, in terms of the approaching system, again, when people are not threatened, when they're not hungry, when they're not in pain, they default usually to a sense of mild contentment. Mild, but pervading, you know, basic well-being, basic contentment. In terms of the attaching system, people default usually to caring. It's remarkable, actually, when people don't feel threatened, how kind they normally are. You know, Gandhi has a wonderful quote about how we pay a lot of attention to war and conflict and arguments and fistfights and verbal brawls and all the rest of that. Sure, but most of daily life is characterized by cooperation. It's as if, you know, when you look outside, there's one cloud in the sky. That's where your attention goes, right? That's sympathetic activation. That's social discord. But the sky altogether, the backdrop, we tend to not notice, in terms of human affairs, is full of relatedness. Right? And then out of all three, we have a kind of synergy of the whole, of a creativity, a generativity. As Eric Erickson said, in midlife, and most of us are in midlife here, some of us are in early midlife, then there's middle midlife, then there's middle, then there's early, late, middle life, you know, whatever. Anyway, it's the tension between stagnation and generativity. Generativity is creativity. It's making new things happen. I think this is the home base of the brain. I think this is the brain in its responsive mode. Okay, so we have a little graphic here of the responsive mode, characterized by, you know, in terms of approaching, gladness or gratitude, in terms of the affiliating or attaching system, characterized by feeling loved and loving, and in terms of the avoiding system, characterized by a quality of peace. The problem is, even though this is our home base, Mother Nature drives us from home to keep us alive. Right? If the avoiding system feels threatened, if the attaching system feels, or rather approaching system feels frustrated or disappointed, or if the attaching system feels disconnected, abandoned, devalued, jealous, envious, what have you, narcissistically wounded and so forth, then bam, we move into this reactive mode very, very quickly. In particular, the avoiding system tends to hijack the other two when we're in this reactive mode. It is rooted in the most ancient part of the brain, the reptilian part of the brain, which is most intense, most inflexible, and most quick. It's the quickest part of the brain. Right? The avoiding system tends to hijack the other two for its ends. All right? This is the reactive mode, you know, at the heart of which is ignorance and suffering. It's interesting to think about extremes of the reactive mode, because we're all in the reactive mode at one time or another, and it's possible to be grounded in the responsive mode in which there's an awareness of reactivity arising. But it's a reactivity that does not hijack the mind. Or in the language of the Buddha, at the highest level, nothing invades the mind and remains. It arises and then passes away. Or as they say in Tibetan Buddhism, the mental afflictions arise and self-dissolve like snowflakes landing on a hot stove. I think it's a nice image. Okay, so this is an extreme, on the other hand, in the reactive mode of various kinds of dysfunctions. And you can see that it's interesting to categorize them. I'm a psychologist, and I think a number of you are therapists. You can break down a lot of the psychiatric diagnoses into these three systems as extremes. You know, it's really interesting to think of it like that. Okay? So that gives us a fundamental choice. You know? We don't get to choose whether we have a brain or not, even if we are in a peak state, even if we have lots of well-being, you know, lots of self-actualization, lots of love, even lots of awakening. We don't get to choose whether we have a brain. We do get to choose which mode it's in. Is it in its reactive mode, or does it return to its home base, which is, alas, so easily disturbed, that's its responsive mode. Now, this is where I love the phrase, taking the fruit as the path. Because, if you recall, neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, if you stimulate a mode of the brain, you strengthen it, for better or worse. So if we clock more time in the right-handed triangle, all right, the responsive mode, the little tag there, RESPO, is really responsive. When I transferred these slides over, I didn't change the titling, so that's what that is there. Anyway, as we clock more time, in a nutshell, gladness in terms of the approaching system, love in terms of the attaching system, and peace in terms of the avoiding system, we deepen the roots. We deepen our keel in the water so that increasingly our responsivity to life, our natural gladness, love, and peace are increasingly unshakable. The winds may blow, they'll move the boat, but they won't tip it all the way over. As we practice taking the fruit as the path, clocking more and more time in activation of this responsive mode, in terms of these three systems, we actually strengthen it. So I've listed here some ways to take the fruit as the path. Some of them are general, some of them are very specific. We've worked through a number of them. Self-compassion is a key way to bring us back into that responsive mode. Taking in the good draws us into that responsive mode. When we're in a good place, which is where we are when we're taking in the good, by definition, we're in that responsive mode. Very often that responsive mode is subtle. It's mild, but it can feel very, very pervading, all right? There are several here that I deliberately listed ones that were not so obvious. Maybe some are, but some may not be. And I just want to call out a couple. And then we'll do a little practice with this. And then Jan and I will hang out with you a bit. And then we'll have a formal end. Okay? So one I really want to draw attention to in the approach system is giving over to your best self. Every one of us has what, you know, Longfellow alluded to. What some of the other quotes have alluded to that I showed on the screen, we all have good qualities. We all have better angels of our nature. You know, giving over to the better angels of our nature, giving over to our higher purposes, you know, giving over to the impulse to take the high road instead of the low one, right? That is a wonderful way to settle into the responsive mode. In terms of the attaching system, I really like the one acting with unilateral virtue. When we ourselves act with unilateral virtue, by our own code, living by our own integrity, no matter what they do, it doesn't mean we're doormats, doesn't mean we're walking on eggshells, it still means speaking truth to power. We're more able to speak truth to power. We're more able to be assertive. We're actually more able to call for better treatment from other people when we're taking the high road ourselves. That too puts us in the responsive mode. And then in terms of the avoiding system, I just think it's so important to recognize paper tigers, especially these days. Every time you walk through an airport, threat level orange. Trust me, it's not threat level orange. The odds of a bad event, orange is the last stop before red. The odds of a bad event on your flight on that day is green with a drop of yellow. It's threat level pale chartreuse, all right? And that's the way it is in life. We live in life. We think we're in threat level orange, right? So much of the time in our relationships. Do I dare soften my heart? Do I dare speak from my heart? Do I dare dream big dreams? Will there be support for me or not? Will I, in the Japanese proverb as it has it, the nail that stands out gets hammered down? Will I get hammered down? Or alternately, is there more support for me out there in the world than I think there is? Are there more resources inside me than I normally credit? Are there greater opportunities out there and in here than I think there are? And are there fewer tigers out there? All right. And I think that's where ignorant, you know, the truth sets us free. But for most of us, in most circumstances, we can afford to feel more confident and better about ourselves and not alarmed and paranoid about paper tigers. So let's close with a bit of a practice here, okay, about gladness, love, and peace. And then Jan and I will just talk. We'll probably go over by about 5 minutes. If you need to leave, it's okay. But we'll probably go over about 5 minutes. But we will end very close to on time. Okay? So for starters, bring to mind something that gives you a feeling of gratitude or gladness. It could be a simple fact of your life, something that's nice or good, something you're grateful for. Open up to a basic feeling of gratitude or gladness. Appreciation. Perhaps a sense of fulfillment as you are. Having already received and then expanding on that sense of gladness to include a sense of being cared about. We spoke of earlier. And with that sense of being cared about, opening as well to your own natural kindness. Experiencing your own kindness, your own lovingness. your own caring for others. Loved and loving. And then with gladness and with love, opening further to a growing sense of peace. With gladness and love, a growing sense of being unthreatened, supported, not at war with anything. A growing tranquility. Not angry or afraid. Peaceful and confident instead. And exploring what it's like as a whole now to have altogether present gladness, love, and peace. Feeling perhaps a kind of coming home to your true nature, the natural state. Grateful, loving, and peaceful. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, how about 5 minutes of final wrap-up, and then we'll stick around for anyone who wants to chat. Please.
There's one little point of confusion that I have, which is...
And if you can stay for the next 5 minutes, please do. If you urgently have to leave, do. But if you can stay, it'll be great. 5 minutes. Okay, Julia.
That I, a little bit of confusion I have because I think with the carrot and the stick, and we would learn faster with a stick. But maybe there's two kinds of learning because there's another kind of learning that we also do through kindness, like dog training. Now we do positive behavior modification. Yeah. We get much faster, much quicker than the old ways of jerking with a leash.
So her comment went to my point that research has shown that generally, unfortunately, alas, being animals learn faster with punishment than with reward. That said, there are certainly some exceptions to that. And I think it could well be that certain social animals, like dogs, who are often trained better through positive reinforcement than negative reinforcement, and humans, the most social animal of all, that there's something so profoundly powerful about the loving brain, the social brain, that it's so rewarding that it trains us best of all. Thanks. Maybe another question or comment?
First, I want to thank both of you for that wild and crazy ride.
There's
so much
fun. 4 hours.
As I was listening to both of you, I was thinking about the whole process of behavior change how challenging it is to change these